Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Announce my first sponsor, Robin Kelson from the Good Seed Company. Welcome, Robin.
Yay! Thank you. I'm so happy to be here and very happy to be your sponsor. We have a large variety of locally adapted, open-pollinated, non-GMO vegetable, flower, and herb seeds. And we hope you'll enjoy visiting our website, goodseedco.net or Good Seed Montana, and seeing the resources that we offer for becoming a better gardener, a better seed saver, and a member of building resiliency around food in your community.
Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast today. I am just super excited because I've been trying to get this guest on for quite a while, and she finally had some time this winter that while things have slowed down, although I have a feeling she was already out in the greenhouse today or the hoop house. And she has just an amazing story to tell us because she's been gardening for a long time. I've heard so many people talk about her. I got to meet her in person and tour her beautiful little farm. So from Purple Frog Gardens in Whitefish, Montana, welcome to the show, Pam Gerwe.
Yeah.
Pam, go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself.
I am interested in a lot of different things. I think I'm a fairly curious person, which fits in really well with my life as a market gardener. I also am actively engaged in community organizing around food systems. I'm a founding member of a local nonprofit called Nourish the Flathead, and I'm also on the board for the North Valley Food Bank, which is a really exciting food bank. We're at an exciting time in our life there. I am 50-something, which is I feel really excited about that time of my life. My partner and I, Mike, have been farming on this land since 1991, so we're at this point where we're like, okay, well, we certainly won't be able to work as hard the next 25 years as we did the last 25 years. So what are we going to do? And we're pretty open and examining a lot of different ideas. We have no holds barred on potential ideas. And yesterday we were talking about raising chickens again for meat birds. We talk about a pizza oven and agritourism a lot, and cooking classes and working with teenagers. And so I feel like we're at a pretty exciting time in our farm. We have a lot of infrastructure laid down already, so we have a lot of different angles we could go towards in the future.
Wow. Well, that does sound exciting. I know, and I'm excited to be in I'm just about to turn 50 pretty quick here, so I just feel like, I was just writing in my journal the other day about how I think I'm the only person in the world who always wants to be older than I am, because I don't know, I think for some reason I always feel like when I get older it's going to get easier. I don't know what I think. Anyway, so you're thinking about going back into raising chickens. Did you raise them before?
We did. At our peak of chicken mayhem, we probably had about 700, 750.
No.
We mostly raised them for layers. We would raise a few meat birds a year, but mostly it was for eggs. And we did it for 20 years. And a couple of years ago, we said, okay, we probably learned about as much as we're going to from this experience, and spent the past couple winters without chickens. And occasionally we'll say, oh, is it time to go get the eggs? Just joking that we don't have to get up in front of the wood stove and go get the eggs. But, you know, there's the demand for local is really high. And I think, you know, the thought that our 50 to 100 hens that we would raise for meat would be raised by us in a humane, pretty nice life, that would be 50 to 100 less birds that would have to be factory farmed. So, you know, we're just talking about it. We don't know if we actually will. A friend of ours, the person that originally first got us started with chickens, he's doing his chick order, and he was just asking me if I wanted any meat birds. And, you know, so that kind of kicked the conversation around in my head. And Mike and I were talking about it, and who knows if we'll really do it. We have a new saying that we're just talking. We're not making a list. just talking. We don't need to start writing down the tools we need and make a plan. We're just talking. So it's exciting.
Okay. But I just got it, like 700 to 750 chickens, mostly for eggs. I mean, that just sounds, you got to tell us a little more about that. Like, I can't even imagine raising 25 or 50 chickens. I mean, we've had, I think, at our peak 10. What's like, how long does it take you to collect eggs from 700? And where do they lay them? And
the 750 was really just one summer that we had that many. And it was a mix of, babies and old girls. And we would have about maybe, I would say probably in peak production, we had maybe 400 laying hens. And then the rest were replacement birds or just really old hens that we hadn't, killing birds is hard. It's sad. They, provided us with a service. So we often would have hens that really weren't laying very many eggs. And we just kept them around. So what we did when we decided we were no longer going to do it, we just slowly, through attrition and not replacing our flock, was how we went down into more reasonable numbers.
Okay. But I still got to know, like, how long does it take you to collect 400 eggs in the morning? Like, do you just go out there with, like, basket? And then what do you have to, like, take them to a market to sell every day? Do you get 400 eggs a day?
No, you wouldn't get, you get about two-thirds of that amount. And then we would, we sold them locally to restaurants. Well, actually, mostly we had a wholesale account. We had a few restaurants that bought a few. And then we did this thing, adopt a chicken. You adopt a chicken, we nanny it, you get eggs, we get money. And that was really the beginning of our adventure into CSA-type marketing. People would pay us in advance for X number of dozen eggs. And that was a really successful way to market the eggs, and people felt engaged and connected to our farm. And I think that's one of my favorite things about the point that we're at, is that a lot of people have known about us for a long time. And sometimes I'll have, young people in their 20s say, "Oh my God, I came to your farm when I was in third grade," or whatever, and this is what happened, and they just remember it so clearly and vividly, and it's pretty exciting to have that body of memory in our community around our farm.
That is awesome. And I'll bet, I remember when I was growing up, there was a farm down the, I don't know, not down the block, but like a little ways away from my parents, and I just remember they would let us come get the carrot tops, and we could go in the back and feed the rabbits. I can still remember that to this day, this cool little farm that my parents would go get vegetables at. That was the fun part for us. Okay, so now just, I'm curious a little more about how that worked. So people would adopt a chicken. How fun is that? And like, would they get to pick it out, and they would see it, and then they would just come get the eggs, like, with their CSA share? Or?
We were not doing a vegetable CSA at that time, and we just had a fridge on our porch, and they would just, a dry erase board, and then they would just come and get the eggs when they wanted them, and then, write their name on the dry erase board, and we would keep track that way.
I love it. And a fridge on your porch, and people could just come help themselves to eggs. That's awesome. All right. So I do always kind of start the show asking people about their very first gardening experience. How old were you? Were you a kid, an adult? Who were you with? What'd you grow? Do you want to tell, like, are you from Whitefish? Tell us about
your first gardening experience. No, I'm from Virginia. And when I was growing up, probably in about junior high, at the house I grew up in, we had a bunch of tomatoes, but that was about it. And I remember liking to check the tomatoes and thinking that was pretty great. But probably the most impactful gardening experience was when we first moved to Whitefish. We lived in town, and our neighbor, Casey Vorman, had a really great garden. And we would bring her our compost and look over her fence and watch everything growing. And that is a garden that I feel, connection to, as far as a mentor and really seeing what you could do in a pretty small space. So
Nice. Okay. So do you want to tell us like what organic gardening or friendly gardening means to you?
I was thinking about this question, and I think it's really important to consider your inputs. And what happened for me was at one point when we had so many chickens, kelp was one of the ingredients that we would feed them. We made up the feed ourselves. We purchased local grains and grew some stuff ourselves and mixed the feed ourselves. And kelp was one of the ingredients. And when you buy a pallet of anything, if you're trying really hard to be mindful of your impact on the planet, you say, wow, I'm buying a whole pallet of kelp. What does that mean? And so I had to begin the research train of figuring out, oh, okay, so this is what they do with kelp. And it's pretty interesting. They have these huge barges that are like lawnmowers, and they just cut the top 10, 20, however many feet of the kelp forest, and then the kelp is able to replenish itself fairly quickly. And, you know, that seemed like a reasonable, sustainable method of an input for us. So I guess I think that's really important, is just for you to continue to consider and examine what you're doing, what your impact in the world is, as far as the choices that you're making.
Awesome. You made your own chicken food? What else goes into chicken food?
Well, we use lentils because it was something we had access to, and the digestive enzyme that chickens need to be able to process lentils, they have to get it when they're young. And so you start mixing in the lentils when they're babies, and then their intestinal flora develops to help make them strong and able to have that be a viable nutrient for them. And then we also use local grains like wheat and barley and oats, just depending upon what we were able to access at a given time. And, you know, probably if we had followed a little bit more of a scientific model, we might have had increased egg production. But it was really important to us to utilize local grain growers. And, you know, something that is always a concern or an issue in animal feed is the protein. And most organic or, you know, much animal feed has soy in it. And, you know, much soy is genetically engineered. And so, and then the soy that's organic is mostly grown in Brazil, cutting down the rainforest. So, you know, you just, it's just this layer after layer of complexity whenever you're accepting responsibility for so much life. And so you just have to ask the questions. And anyway, that was about the basic mixture. We also would sprout grains, and the chickens really like that. We would sprout them all the way up to grass and then give it to them in the winter.
Wow. I knew you were going to be an awesome interview full of tons of stuff. Okay. Do you want to tell us who or what inspired you to start using organic techniques?
I think I've always just known that organic was really the only way to go. And one of the things, you know, that I've learned as we've gone on is, you know, part of it is your resource availability. We are incredibly lucky because when we first moved to our farm, it's very clay, very, very clay rock, not very good soil. And so we were really looking for biomass to help increase the topsoil. And I called the city and said, hey, what do you do with your leaves in the fall? And they said, oh, well, we burn them. And I said, oh, my God. You know, that's terrible. And so I began a relationship with the city of Whitefish, and they have been bringing us all the residents' leaves for the, you know, past 20 something years. And so we've opened hundreds and thousands of leaf bags, and that's basic one of our plans for our soil fertility. And so anyway, organic is like looking into the resources in your community that are often byproducts, but that will help increase your soil fertility.
That's wonderful. And I think that's going to give people tons of ideas.
I guess one caveat would be with grass clippings at, you know, early on in our career when we were really struggling, like I said, with soil fertility, we had a couple of lawn maintenance people who would bring us grass clippings. But the reality is that most people really spray a lot of terrible chemicals on their lawn. You know, I think one of the largest consumers of Roundup is the household yard. And, you know, So at some point we were like, wait a minute, we can't do this anymore. So pretty early on, we decided that even though it was just this beautiful, bountiful supply of nitrogen coming to the farm, we just couldn't do it because we couldn't keep, you know, follow the train of clean grass clippings versus dirty ones. And it really makes a difference. I think you, there's quite a few plants that if you put poison grass in your garden, you will see the ramifications of that for a couple of years, several years. So,
you know, that's been probably one of the biggest things I've learned since I started my podcast last year is that, the chemicals they put on the grass is like one of the most dangerous, crazy things that we do, especially for like toddlers. People then let their kids learn how to crawl on the grass, and also for pets. Like, I had no idea how bad those chemicals were. I think because I just never paid attention because, you know, we weren't going to spray them on our lawn. And my mom, I grew up and we didn't spray them at my mom's. But I've a lot of people have talked about how just incredibly dangerous those chemicals are.
Well, when your company is called ChemLawn, you can, you know, that's. Anyway.
I meant to ask you when you first started talking about the food bank and what's exciting going to happen at the food bank this year.
The North Valley Food Bank is, Whitefish is a very generous community, and the North Valley Food Bank is just this amazing new building that was built a couple of years ago. Our founder in chief, June Munsky, had volunteered so long in the community to help with food security issues. And she was in her 80s, and the community, you know, could see that she had devoted her life towards this issue. And I think, kind of in recognition of that, helped build this amazing facility that we now have, and it's spacious and light and it has a great kitchen and a small butcher shop, and it's just really has a lot of potential. And June was able to serve our clients one time and then in our new facility, and then she was not able to help any longer, and within a very short amount of time passed away. And I think it was just so great that she got to see all of her hard work, her new facility, and then go and be able to serve clients one more time in this new, one time in this new facility. And so we, as a board and as an organization, have been in that space where, oh, we're grieving our founding member. We're getting a new building and trying to just figure out how to handle those two things simultaneously. And we've hired our first employee. Everybody has always been volunteers, and that our executive director is doing a really good job. She's getting her footing in the community, and we've kind of stabilized from those two huge transitions, and now we're just kind of looking forward at all the potential impact we can have in our community and how to best serve our clients. So sky's the limit.
Aww, I like that. I'm sorry to hear about June, but that's still a touching story. Yeah. Okay, so do you want to tell us how you learned how to grow a garden organically?
I think mostly it was just trial and error, practice, reading about it, and then having a few mentors. And I think just finding people that you have respect for. Casey definitely told me some stuff about her garden that we used to peer over the fence at. And then we had a mentor who lived next door to us who was very helpful. Gladys helped, answered a lot of questions, taught me how to slaughter chickens, really was someone who knew a lot had a lot of information that I didn't have. I grew up in suburban USA, and so there were a lot of things that I wanted to incorporate into my life, but I had no idea how to do them. And Mike had a little more experience than I did in that arena, but Gladys definitely taught both of us a lot.
Okay. So do you want to tell us about something that grew well this year?
This year we had a really nice apple and pear crop, which is really exciting to us because we've been joking for years that the apples and pears trees that we planted were our 401k. And that's what we had invested, our retirement was invested in them. And when we first planted them, we were not able to give them the amount of attention that a potentially 100-year-old plant really deserves in the beginning of its life. And so they kind of struggled in the early years because they didn't scream as loud as the annuals. And so now we're really starting to take much better care of them, give them a lot of love. We're learning a lot about pruning. Each year we learn more and more. With pruning, I think, is really an art. And our trees were very productive this year. And it's really we've been waiting a long time for them to start producing like they did this year. And one thing that was really interesting that happened was we were pretty short-staffed this summer, and we were pretty tired. And usually we have tons and tons and tons of raspberries, and it takes zillions of hours to pick them over and over again. And we had a very slight raspberry crop this year, which was such a gift because we wouldn't really have had the time to stay smiling and pick the raspberries. So anyway, I just think it's neat when those things kind of work out like that.
We didn't have a very big, our raspberries just totally vanished this year. I don't know what happened. Maybe it was the weather. Two things. One of my most listened to guests is this guy, Russ Medge from, I think he's in Salt Lake City. He's in Utah. And he talks about tree pruning, and how to do that and the importance of that. And the difference between pruning a fruit tree and pruning a flowering tree, which I didn't know that there was a difference there. And then also, so do you have any other tips for us? Like, what did you do? Like, that's interesting that your trees were kind of struggling and weren't saying anything, and then you feel like you gave them some attention. What other things, kind of attention do they like?
Well, I think one, probably the most important thing is what's the saying? It's like a $3 tree and a $20 hole or something like that. Because really the early care of the tree matters a lot. I think one of the things that happens on homesteads is that you always think you're going to get to it. Oh yeah, I'm going to plant this tree and then I'm going to hook up the irrigation. And then suddenly it's July and you're like, damn, I still haven't hooked up that irrigation. And then it's August and, you know, you're carrying buckets of water to the tree because you can't get the irrigation set up. So I think, you know, the later trees that we planted, we just stopped planting them until we got the irrigation set up, because you just get so busy and you have the world's best intentions, but that's not enough. So I think that making sure everything had enough water, and then also just started fertilizing and then pruning a little more severely was how we were able to, you know, bringing our trees into production.
Mm-hmm. I think, and that was I was kind of telling you a little bit in the beginning that we've always had a water shortage, and I think having the water this year made a big difference on our fruit trees too. So I think that water is the key. Okay, how about, is there something you're excited to do different next year, or something you're excited to try new?
Yeah, we're going to really expand our green onion and our radish production. There's so many beautiful colors of radishes, and I just love the visual in my head of a table full of all different colors and sizes and shapes of radishes. Plus, I really like radishes. And then green onions are just really help round out pretty much any meal. So I think having access to the Allium family pretty early in the in the summer and then consistently throughout is just so nice. And plus, you know, they're easy to eat raw. So I really am planning on expanding those. And then I'm starting to get really interested in agroforestry, which is, you know, a permaculture model of planting. When you plant your trees, you do multiple canopies and also, you know, use a lot of the byproducts that fall down from the tree to help make a big bed of mulch and add fertility to the soil. And I'm excited to start using the areas between our fruit trees. Right now, they've just been planted with cover crop or a lot of weeds, and we're ready to start utilizing that soil around them and then that whole little microclimate that the trees help create.
Ooh, cool. I like that. I've heard a little bit about it, but not quite that much in depth. Do you have a good recipe for radishes? What do you like to do with your radishes?
I like to just eat them raw, and I'm also a pretty big fermenter. So fermented radishes are really nice. And then one of the I see one of the questions you're going to ask later is about a favorite recipe. And one of the things that we try our hardest to make sure that we always have is something in the fridge that we just call shred. And it's whatever vegetable that we have a lot of, a mixture of them. And right now the shred in our refrigerator is cabbage, some onions, carrots, and then some winter rose radishes. And it's, if you have a big bag of shredded vegetables in your refrigerator, you're going to eat them. You're going to, you know, put them into a spring roll, you're going to put them into your quesadilla, you're going to just eat them as a salad, you're going to put them in your soup. And I think, you know, one of the ways that we can be successful with the local food diet is if we figure out more ways to make it very easy for people to incorporate it into their eating patterns. And people are just so busy and don't necessarily think that feeding themselves is as important as it might really be. So I think just helping people figure out, oh my God, there's this huge bag of shredded vegetables in my refrigerator. Of course I can incorporate that, you know, put some of that on my pizza or put some of that on whatever it is that you're eating.
That's interesting. So when you say shredded, like, what do? You throw them through the food processor on like the grating setting, or like, how are you shredding them?
It depends what it is. You know, like the cabbage, we usually use the blade, you know, to get thicker pieces. But then with the carrots, we'll just grate them, you know, and it depends on what you're going to do with it or what you do the most of it. I use a lot of rice wraps and we make spring rolls, and a finer texture works better for that. But it just, you know, today we had salad with it and with the shred, and it's just a really easy way to make sure that you utilize the food that you have. Another thing, way that we do it is, you know, we have a lot of frozen produce that from the summer. And so, like, I just pulled a quart of Sun Gold cherry tomatoes out and put it in the refrigerator, and you just add 5 to 10 Sun Golds to whatever it is that you're cooking. And, you know, you just keep utilizing them a little bit at a time in whatever dish that you're making. And that seems to really be an easy way for us to make sure that we eat the, you know, the effort of our labor, the fruit of our labor. So,
yep. Mike and I both decided for sure that one of our investments next year is going to be a freezer. We need an extra freezer so we can save some more of our food. Now that we can grow more food, I guess maybe that's where it's coming from. And then I learned also, Megan King came on this guest and she talked about how easy it is to freeze peppers. Like, I never knew. And then you're talking about tomatoes. Somebody else talked about you can just throw them in the freezer like that. And they're, you know, they're not going to be fresh, but for cooking. So, yeah, cool. I'm like, you know, I eat a lot of vegetables. That's not one of the things that I have a shortage of. Mine's always fruit. But I do, you'll see, there's also the question about, well, we'll get to there, about what to do with my keeping food from going bad when it all comes on at once. But let's, anyway, do you want to tell us about something that didn't work so well this season or didn't come out the way you wanted or you were surprised with?
We historically have grown a lot of kale, and our kale this year just was not happening. Our Chinese cabbage, also that same family, it all bolted, and it just got hot so fast this spring that the Chinese cabbage couldn't get mature before it went into stress panic mode and said, we better make some seeds. And the kale was really surprising. We had terrible aphids, and we grow rows and rows of kale spread throughout the farm, and, you know, a block here and a block there and a block over there. And each of the blocks eventually was hammered by the aphids. And we were very surprised, especially because that's something we don't have in the freezer, and we usually have gallons and gallons of it in the freezer, but it didn't work out this year.
It was so hot so fast last year. Yeah, my spinach, like, it was like it came out of the ground and bolted like the same week, it seemed like, or something. But then we did end up having a really good fall crop of spinach this year. Like, it just went to seed and it came, and then the fall it was sweeter than ever. But your kale didn't do it. Well, I guess if you had aphids, that wouldn't. That was going to be my thing. I was going to try to grow kale. I've never grown kale, but maybe next year. All right. How about something that you find is easy to grow and successful generally every time, like all the time? Something, would that be kale?
That's kale and Chinese cabbage. So I think that's part of the reason why it was so shocking to us, because generally that would be, both the kale and the Chinese cabbage would be crops that I would recommend to people because they are fairly easy. And I had fun answering that question before the interview, going like, same answer.
I know. Well, let's hope we don't ever have a year like last year. I mean, I just thought that was crazy. I mean, it seemed like by the end of February, we were practically digging in the garden, and March, you know, you could plant in the yard. Just very unusual year last year, I hope. How about something you'd steer new gardeners away from that you find is typically challenging to grow in your climate?
You know, I really would say nothing, that there's nothing you shouldn't try. I think that the sooner people can get comfortable with being unsuccessful with a few things, the better their garden's going to be, the more brave they're going to be. It's just the way gardening is. You know, you have to learn to become comfortable with failure. You know, just because my kale crop didn't do very good this year doesn't mean that I'm not going to come back with a bit more of a vengeance for next year trying it, because I like it so much. And then also, I just think it's an important you know, food for people to start getting continue their familiarity with, but then also, you know, for people who don't know about it to start introducing it into their diet.
What do you like to do with kale? Because, like, I'm one of those people that, like, the only thing I'd done with kale before was, like, you know, the green smoothie thing, and I'm not a big green smoothie drinker anyway, so I've been buying a little bit of kale here and there, and just like, what are some good ways to incorporate kale into your diet if you're not a kale eater?
Well, we like usually put a lot of it into the shred that we make in the winter, and then just use it however we use the mixed vegetables, the shredded mixed vegetables, whether it's salad or, you know, the things I previously talked about, rice wraps, smoothies, pizza, that kind of thing. And then also we dehydrate a lot of kale, and we make a pretty good, you know, sauce that we put on it before, what's got, you know, tamari or some kind of oil, olive oil or some whatever kind of oil is close by, and then brewer's yeast and maybe sesame seeds. And a couple years ago we had a ton of leeks, and we added the leeks to the mixture, and then also sun-dried tomatoes, and it was like almost a cracker, and it was really good. And I think dehydrating produce is a really good way. You know, you can take a box, an apple box full of kale, and it ends up being, you know, 2 or 3 Ziploc bags, gallon Ziploc bags. It really concentrates the nutrients and the space that you'll need.
Nice. Okay. There's some great ideas. How about, I just have to ask, I don't know why this, like, I pictured this. So is kale kind of like adding kelp? Is it same kind of green, or is it totally different green? to your soil?
The kelp is in a byproduct, you know, it's been cut down and you're adding it to the soil. The kale is taking from the soil. You know what I mean? Because it's planted. The kelp is just something you sprinkle on the soil.
Okay.
It's not something we grow. You know, kelp grows in the ocean.
True. I don't know why I was just picturing like the kale would like, you know, crumble into like a powder that would look like kelp powder.
Oh, I see. You can crumble it and we may do that and with a little bit, and then we just put that on popcorn.
Ooh, I like that. Okay. How about your least favorite activity to do in the garden? Is there something you have to force yourself to get out there and do?
You know, I really like pretty much everything in the garden. I think it becomes arduous or hard when I'm feeling like I don't have enough time to do what I need to do. And that's probably the most frustrating thing for me, because I do enjoy it and I don't mind kind of meandering my way through it. But when I feel really rushed, sometimes I don't like it. Sometimes I can get into a great groove and just be going pretty fast and doing what I need to. But sometimes it, you know, if it's only like that, it feels pretty less enjoyable.
Okay. How about your favorite activity to do in the garden?
You know, I really like working with other people in the garden. We have a pretty good volunteer day. That's every Wednesday in the summer from 9 to 1, and people come and they help us, and then we give them produce at the end. And I think that's a great interaction with people in our community. And there's often just such interesting conversations happening. One day there was, two different sets of people who were trying to learn Mandarin, and they were counting to 10 in Chinese. And it's like, it's so random. Why did that happen another time? It was one of our hugest days. I think there were 18 volunteers that showed up, and 3 of them were from the Netherlands and they didn't know each other. They just randomly happened to show up on the same day. So
that's crazy.
Yeah, it is. But I also really enjoy working in the garden by myself. And again, like, I need that balance of having really interactive, engaging time with people. I think is super fun. But then I also have to have time where I'm alone in the garden and I'm, you know, making the list, but then also just enjoying myself and being by myself and having that time to more meander through a project rather than, you know, trying to tell somebody else what to do or engage with them or have conversation or whatever. So I like them both.
Do you want to tell listeners, maybe we should have talked about this a little bit before, but like, what kind of community Whitefish, like, it's kind of a tourist place. So like, because they're probably like, where did 3 people from the Netherlands show up at one time? Like, and where do you like advertise that? Like, people, when you first said the volunteer thing, I figured it was going to be consistently like the same few people, but it sounds like you're getting kind of a diverse crowd.
Yeah, it's more I think the consistent thing is the time. It's every Wednesday, 9 to 1. And because we are a production farm, we really discourage people from just stopping by, because when you're interrupted, you know, it could take quite a while to get back to where you were. So it's also very important for us to have people have the opportunity to participate and to be in the soil and to see what's happening. And so I think because it's consistently been Wednesday for about the past 20 something years, people in the community know about it. And I remember one day a woman said, you know, I've never come to volunteer day, but I just want you to know that every Wednesday in the summer, almost every Wednesday in the summer when I'm at work, I think of you guys. And, you know, it's so neat to think about that energy being in the community. And, you know, I think her thinking of us, it's just so great. And I think it helps make Purple Frog such a special place.
Nice. That's amazing. 20 years. Okay. How about the best gardening advice you've ever received?
I think this was more like a lesson that happened, and it would be to use what you grow. And the story that I still think about, you know, so many years later was when we were first getting going with the garden, we were also building our home, and we were building our greenhouse, and we were building our barn, and we were trying to figure everything out, put the water lines in, blah, blah, blah. And we ended up having maybe half a dozen cabbages that were big and beautiful, and we'd harvested them and we sat them on the porch. And then we just were doing what we were doing. And every day we would walk past these cabbages and be like, oh God, we got to deal with the cabbages. And it's like, but we got to do this and we got to do this, and winter's coming and this isn't closed in. And then it was like weeks later, they were frozen solid and they were just sitting there on the porch kind of mocking us as we walked past. And just, you know, I think that was the last thing that I was willing to let go of, you know, as far as food waste. And so we're very almost everything that we produce now is used, whether it's used through the people that come to volunteer day, through our CSA, or through us processing it ourselves. But that's why you do it. So you you do it so you can enjoy the food. And so I think that would be the most important thing, is just not to make your life so chaotic so that you can't reap the harvest.
Okay, cool. How about a favorite tool that you like to use? Like, if you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what would it be?
I'm taking two tools.
Okay.
And one of them would just be a fork, a soil fork. It's, you know, four tines flat. And they're, I don't know, about the whole tool is about 6 to 8 inches apart, or the head of the whole tool. And then the teeth are, oh, it must be a little bit farther than that, because the teeth are 2 to 3 inches apart. And it's just really good for getting out quack grass and breaking up dirt clods without damaging the soil structure as much as a tractor or rototiller. And then the Cobra, which is just a small tool, hand tool, that's a semicircle and it's got a head that looks like a diamond, kind of like a cobra head. And that's just for hand weeding and getting in tight spaces. And I think both of those tools are very valuable. And depending upon whether you're standing up in a bigger space or down on your knees in a tighter space.
Wow, I never heard of that Cobra thing. I'll have to check that out. Maybe if you have a picture of that, I could grab a picture of that.
Oh, yeah.
Cool. Okay, so this is kind of like where I'm at every year. It never seems to fail. I took this question out. I put it right back in this fall. So do you have tips for eating or harvesting vegetables or fruit on time? Because for me, it just seems like I always end up with too much stuff all at once. Like this fall, I ended up with too many zucchinis and eggplants all at once. But it's like, it's never enough to really, or even if I do give them away to the people I work with, it's never enough to, like, you know, to try to sell or to, like, you know, make an extra trip to town on the day the food pantry is collecting if I'm not actually going on that day. Or it just seems like I always end up with this abundance of something. Usually it's lettuce in the spring, but this year it was eggplants and zucchinis in the fall.
I think it's just a matter of just prioritizing it, that that's what you're going to do, that you have to set it up so that you can use it. And the things that I was thinking of, we don't grow very many eggplants, but I really like them. And probably what I would have done would maybe been to have made some baba ganoush or some kind of dip or even excuse me, I've never tried dehydrating them. Maybe that, or maybe just roasting them. And then we roast a lot of our vegetables and then freeze them. So whenever I'm making the commitment to roast, we have a really big pan that, you know, is like a restaurant pan, and I'll just fill it with vegetables, with carrots and garlic and onions and potatoes and Jerusalem artichokes and whatever vegetable, maybe some squash pieces, and then roast the whole pan and then keep some in the refrigerator for instant consumption, and then put the rest in a big glass container, freezer bag, and then just dip into it as I need just a little smaller quantity. But I think that learning how to cook with local ingredients is a really good thing for people to do, maybe even before they plant a huge garden. I mean, you're gonna figure it out, I guess, if you have a huge garden, but yeah.
Okay. I like a lot of those tips.
Oh, and the zucchini, the noodles, the spiralizer. We don't have one of them, but there's a way you can make noodles out of zucchini, and I think that that's really a great way to use a lot. And then what I would do would be to grate a lot of the zucchini and then just freeze it and then use it for zucchini bread or maybe put it in chili or something like that over the course of the winter.
Zucchini noodles? Ooh, that sounds really good. And my husband likes to make noodles. So maybe that
would be nice.
Yeah. You know what he does? He makes macaroons, and then when he has the leftover egg yolks from the macaroons, he'll make homemade noodles sometimes. He's quite the baker. Do you have any secrets for preserving food or making it last? I mean, you've told us a lot, so we could kind of skip this question unless you have something that you were saving for it.
I think just the fermentation process is something that any person who's going to grow a lot of food should learn about. And that's, you know, sauerkraut or kimchi. Right now in our refrigerator, we have some fermented jalapenos that we use like hot sauce. We have fermented horseradish and sauerkraut. I think that's all we have right now. But yeah, but just it's a great way to help and improve your intestinal flora, and salt is a preservative. So I think that learning how to do that is a really important skill that will help you process a lot of vegetables.
Okay. That sounds really good. Now, horseradish is like a root vegetable that you grow. Is it like a radish?
No, it's a root. It's a straight root. It looks like burdock or kind of a maybe about the size of a carrot with some side shoots off of it. And if you like strong horseradish, you would dig it in the spring or in the fall, because at that point the plant's volatile oils are in the roots rather than in the green. In the summer, that volatility transfers up to the greens because the plant is interested in production. But in the spring, it's just waking up from the ground and then getting started on the greens. And then in the fall, it's pulling its, you know, life force back into the root system. So those are the times that you would harvest those horseradish to eat.
Now, what kind of plant is that? Is that like a seed, like a carrot that you plant every year, or is it come back like a herb?
Oh, you got to plant it on the edge of your garden. It's a very prolific plant. Yeah, so you plant it. It's a root, and you just plant it on the edge of your garden because it's really strong. It can be kind of invasive if you don't watch it. And then, so what we do is we harvest our horseradish, and then we leave the top inch with the green on it, and then we put those in pots, several in a pot, and we let them root, and then the next year we'll plant them in the garden. We grow quite a bit of horseradish, and mostly just because we really like it. We sell some of it, and we put some of it in our CSA, but it's not really something that, you know, people are clamoring for.
It sounds so good though. Like fresh horseradish. I don't think I've ever had fresh horseradish.
It's good.
But yeah, and I've really, I don't know, like found some horseradish mustard I've been eating a lot of lately. I'm going to have to try some of those seeds. I'll have to look for horseradish next year. Okay, how about a favorite recipe you like to cook from the garden?
I think it was just that shred that I was talking about, just the grated or chopped up real small vegetables, mixed vegetables in a bag in the fridge that you can grab at any moment. And then the other thing I really like is the caramelized roasted vegetables. And they can just really help round out any meal, just a few of them. So.
Now, how do you caramelize them?
Well, like with onions or tomatoes, you just cook them slow and hot, and then the sugars in them start to, I don't know. I guess we need a culinary person online to tell us about the chemical composition that makes caramelizing happen. But
you don't actually put like some kind of sugar or anything in it
then? No, it's just the sugar of the vegetable.
Okay, yum. How about, do you have a favorite internet resource anywhere on the web that you like to go?
You know, when I saw that question, I just started laughing and was like, Google. And I know that you were speaking more specifically about one that I go to, regularly, but I just think the internet is such an amazing resource. And just thinking about how when I was in college, it was not a resource that was, it didn't exist. And so how lucky we are now that if you want to learn anything, you can find people who will teach you and who will share their knowledge. People are so generous with sharing how they've done something or how they hope to do something. And, I put a list of some of the things that I've been looking up. I look up a lot of things over the winter, and some of the searches that I've been doing is reforesting the desert. That fits in with the agroforestry goals that I have for the summer. Rocket stove pizza oven. I really want to build a pizza oven and start having gatherings where people would come here to the farm and share dinner. And, you know, the pizza would be a value-added product, meaning we would take our product and then the things that we grow, and then we would process them to the next level, and then we would be able to charge a little bit more for our pound of tomatoes or whatever it was that we transferred into the pizza. How to make liquor or fuel, make a bouquet out of Berplurium, which is this one flower that we grow a lot of, and slaughter a pig. And I didn't really look up slaughter a pig because I'm not going to slaughter a pig. But, you know, you could find that information there if you just wanted to. So I think just appreciate the resource, and we live in such a time with such a wealth of information at our fingertips that we can do whatever we want and we can learn from other people's mistakes, which I feel is kind of important at this point because the speed with which things are changing on the planet, we are going to need to have a lot of people who are really capable and confident when they try things, and then also people willing to share their mistakes so that we don't have to replicate mistakes over and over again.
Awesome. That was really in depth. Believe it or not, you're not the first. You're not even the second person to mention Google as their resource. I think we all kind of feel that way, that it's really nice to be able to go out there and look. And YouTube, you know, especially they say YouTube's the biggest information place out there. How about a favorite reading material, like a book or a magazine or a blog that you can recommend that you really like?
I think I really, it's hard to narrow it all down, but one thing that I'm really enjoying is a couple of books by Ruth Stout. She wrote How to Have a Green Thumb Without an Aching Back and The No Work Garden, I think. And she uses the way she would treat the soil was with very thick layers of mulch. And I just like that idea. It's pre-permaculture language, but that's really kind of what her vision was that you would just feed the soil with lots of biomass and it would choke out weeds. And she was an older woman when she wrote the books and just talked about how it really, the mulch as a weed suppression and also fertility facilitated her being able to have a fairly large garden for most of her life.
Nice. Okay, I'll have to check some of those out. Okay, so since you do have a business, do you have some advice for listeners on like how to sell extra produce or how to get started in the industry if they want to, like me?
I think one of the things that I think that we maybe as a society need to start thinking about, thinking about the idea of a one-person CSA. So you're producing more than you and your family can eat. And what's wrong with asking your neighbor in the spring, hey, I'm going to do this. Will you make a commitment to me? Would you be willing to, you know, buy one CSA from me and I'll give you produce every week? Or do you have something that you could trade me for produce every week? And so just looking at that idea of it doesn't have to be a 30-person or 200-person CSA. And just for the people who are interested in doing it, thinking about what their commitment to it is and what their goals are. Because some people would be really happy to make $1,000 a year. Some people want to make it their livelihood and need to make a little bit more money than that. So I think just identifying where the potential producer's desire is really important. And then another thing that we have a huge dearth of is nowhere near enough of is value-added producers. We need people, processors like Del Monte in our small communities. You know, if I had someone, if there was a local pickle maker who was going to buy X amount of cucumbers from me, it would be so helpful because the pickles would showcase what's being grown in the valley. The pickle maker would be helping with jobs in the community. One of the byproducts of value-added processing of making a food product is there's often a jar that's a little too full or not quite full enough, and then those byproducts end up getting put into the like the food bank stream because they're not sellable. And just thinking about that whole industry of food processing and how it used to be in our communities, we used to have cheesemakers and we used to have more bakers and flour mills, and we certainly have a lot of brewers now in Montana, so we're getting breweries and distilleries covered to use our local grains. But you know, just across the spectrum of food, we need more processors. And so I would encourage people who love the food system to think about that as being a business. That's a service that we really need.
Really awesome. My husband just keeps talking about pickles. Like every time we mention the farmer's market, he's like, yep, and you gotta have pickles there for kids to grab a big, huge pickle. And he's just really, and he makes delicious pickles. And he makes like delicious pickled, like pickled beets and bread and butter pickles and bread and butter squash. And he pickled jalapenos one year and asparagus. And a business just out of pickles.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
That's excellent. And, you know, like I said, 116 interviews, and I don't think anybody said anything like that. So, cool. So, do you have a little advice for listeners about how to, like, get started in the industry or sell extra produce or something that you could share with us about that? Or did you have some more to add to that?
I did have a little bit more to add. And one of the stories I was thinking about was my friend Jennifer Montague, who is a nutritionist who became involved with School District 5 in Kalispell with their food procurement and overseeing the whole school kitchen process. And she ended up working with Food Corps, which is a national program that resembles Stateside Vista. It's like AmeriCorps or Vista. A program where young people spend 2 years or 1 year doing service in school districts and trying to connect local farmers with their school system. And one of the things that Jenny did was worked with her food corps person, Katie Wheeler, and they were able to help Lower Valley Meats, which is a local butcher, acquire the proper size patty maker, because the USDA has rules for the size hamburg that has to be used in the school district, and the local butcher didn't have the equipment. Their patty maker was a little bigger. And so they got a grant, they got the butcher got the equipment, and now a lot of our local Flathead Valley school children have beef from the Flathead Valley rather than beef that was processed in Texas or Nebraska or, you know, Brazil. So I think the interactions that people can have with their food system can be a lot of different careers. And I just think it's really important as we have more and more nonprofits that are involved in the food system, whether it's food security or school gardens or community gardens, there's going to be more and more employment opportunities to hook people into making a career of the food system. So while I think it's really important that people are getting in the dirt and having a relationship with the soil, I also think there's a lot of other opportunities of how people can use their livelihoods to interact with the food system.
Awesome. So when you say Lower Valley Meats, is that like from the Lower Valley Farm, like Jay and Mandy, or is that just you mean Lower Valley like it's part of the Flathead Valley?
That's just the name of the butcher. It's in the Lower Valley. I think it's a third generation butcher. It's a fairly small family operation, but there's not very many. One of the things that's happened with the infrastructure around the country is that a lot of it has disappeared. So it's very difficult for small processors to have a place that's been certified so that they can have their meat processed and then resell it. You know, right now, there's more places available, but you would have to, you as a consumer would have to buy a half or a quarter of a beef or a cow or a beef or a pig or a lamb. And a lot of people, consumers, haven't quite gotten that in their head that, oh, this is the way the animal exists and this is the way they purchase it. You know, they're more interested in getting one or two meals at the store. And that's a more rigorous process for local processing. So Lower Valley Meats is just the name of the butcher down in the Lower Valley of the Flathead.
Okay. Yeah, and that's awesome to hear. I had two guests on, one who talked about AmeriCorps and the food corps program over on the east side out of Haver, Rosie Golditch, and then also this woman, Patty Armbrister, who's from, oh, how could I forget the name? Somewhere really on the east side. It starts with an H. And she worked really hard to get meat from Montana to the kids in their area. They were importing it from Texas, and she was just appalled. But they were not able to find a local. The closest local processor ended up being like in, I want to say, Chinook or Shoto. I always get those two places mixed up. So it was still like 2.5 hours. So they were kind of having a hard time there. But yeah, so that's great to hear that Kalispell schools are getting local food. Especially local meat.
Right. And you know, when we look at the history of the food system, it's pretty fascinating. All the schools had kitchens. They had the stoves. They had the bakery things. They had the soup kettles and everything. And then as our food system evolved and became more mechanized and more processed, the food conglomerates recognized the incredible amount of money that was available from getting a government contract. And so the school kitchens became deconstructed. And so that's a big challenge that a lot of the food corps people around the country are facing, is how do we reconstruct our kitchens at our schools?
So, yeah. Well, that's awesome. Thank you for sharing that, because I think people might be like, oh, wow, I can get help to buy one of those patty makers or whatever it is. That's right. Great to know that there's resources out there for people that will inspire them.
Right.
Okay, and then was there something else you wanted to talk about?
Oh, yeah, and then the other comment that I had, and this was more towards contact.
Oh, yeah, right. How do we connect with you?
Yes, how to connect with Purple Frog Gardens. And as I mentioned a couple times during the interview, that Wednesday is our volunteer day. That's Wednesday from 9 to 1. And that usually starts sometime mid to late April. And then also Friday nights, we have a farm stand that's open on the farm. And it's open from 5 to 7:30. And people come, our CSA subscribers come and pick up their CSA share that night. But then we also have a farm stand where there's product available for sale. We purchase local cheese from Flathead Cheese Company, and then we also have some bread available from Polebridge Bakery, and then we often will purchase fruit from people that have fruit that we don't, you know, we don't grow peaches here because it's too cold, but we live real close to Flathead Lake, or relatively close to Flathead Lake, and so we'll get some peaches from down that way and some plums too. And the farm stand is, the salad barn is a really great community opportunity to engage. And people come and they maybe buy something, but maybe they just come to hang out and have community. So that's another chance where people can come and spend some time on the farm. And the people are welcome to walk around the farm. I don't lead formal tours on Friday night, but people can certainly walk around and see what we have going on out there in the fields.
Wow. Well, thank you so much. I'm so glad to hear about that. I didn't know that you could come down and buy things from the farm stand on Friday nights. So that's kind of a nice bonus. I wish I would have known that all those years traveling back and forth from Browning, going right through Whitefish every Friday night.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And
but I'm sure it's not going to be the last.
No. And part of the reason we set up the farm stand was because at Farmers Market, which the downtown Whitefish Farmers Market is on Tuesday nights from 5 to 7:30. And we just, it's so busy and so big and so many people. And we just really didn't have the opportunity to have much of a conversation with any of our customers. And, you know, part of what we do, we really like talking to the people who are going to eat our food. So we're not able to have too long of a conversation at market because we're so busy, but the farm stand is a little more mellow and kicked back, and we can have longer, you know, more heartfelt conversations with people. So
nice. Okay, perfect. Well, thanks so much for calling me back, or letting me call you back and letting us share a little more.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And I see we're at 9:11, so I did pretty good. I said only 5 minutes, but yeah. Well, I appreciate your time, Jackie, and thanks so much for letting me add those two things. I'm not sure why they seem so important to me, but they did. So,
because they're going to make a difference in somebody's life.
Right.
That's why.
Yeah. We can only hope.
Oh, I'm sure of it. Somebody's going to hear this and either, you know, have their own farm stand that's going to change something, or they're going to come to your farm stand and become a Whitefish native, or they're going to get one of those meat patty things, or I don't know. I just right. believe it. Okay. Somebody needed to hear that.
Yeah. And I can't believe that this, I don't know how you splice all this together or if this is even possible. But the other thing that I got distracted by the patty maker. But the exciting thing is Jenny Monacue no longer serves in School District 5. She's in Alexandria, Virginia, working for USDA on a national level with Farm to School. So, you know, you just never know where it's going to end up. And she started here, fresh out of college, doing this thing, and now she's has the opportunity to impact national policy at schools all around the country through her great leadership. So
awesome.
Yes, that Excellent. Was the part I really wanted to tell. So
go right. Jenny.
Yeah Well, thanks very much. I appreciate your time and your work.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate all that you do too. You're an amazing woman. Ready for the final question?
Yes.
Okay. If there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity organization you're passionate about or a project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel, Pam, is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
Well, I'm I bullied my way into getting two tools, and I'm going to bully my way into getting two concepts.
Awesome.
That I'm going to talk about. And the first one is the idea of food waste. As a world, we're throwing away, I think it's about 50% of the food that's produced, whether that's leaving it in the farmer's field all the way down the food process to, oh, dang, I let it rot in my refrigerator. And so 50% of the food production on our planet is thrown away, and there's such a huge amount of people that are hungry. And the talk of genetically modified food is always like, well, we want to feed the people of the world. Well, we want to feed the people of the world. Well, we have the potential right now to feed the people of the world without compromising the seed, if we just start to look at wasting less food. And I think that that's a really important aspect that we're going to need to examine more and more. And I think that that's all along the spectrum. One of the things that we've been struggling with at our food bank is we get amazing amount of donations from our local stores. And there's part of it that's really wonderful and great. But a lot of the food that comes into the food bank stream is really bad food. It's cakes with huge frostings, it's donuts, it's cookies, it's ho-hos, it's Twinkies. It's food that we certainly don't want to give to the poorest, most compromised people in our society. Already their health is in so much jeopardy because of the stress of being impoverished in our world. And we're going to give them these terrible, terrible foods. So I think that's just another aspect of the conversation that I'm going to be focusing on as we move forward. And then the other thing that's, I just have to start saying it, is the concept of basic income for all. And we need to, I think we need to start looking at the idea that we know that when people's lives are compromised through poverty, it costs society quite a bit of money through jails, through emergency visits, through, you know, criminal activity that happens as a result of people being so impoverished, on and on and on. And there's so much wealth in the world. You know, we have 62 people who have as much money as half of the world's population. And if we have the political and societal will to redirect some of the funds that we've allowed get concentrated into those hands, there's enough money and wealth in the world so that everybody could have their basic living needs met. And I just think that's such an exciting concept, because the creativity and the passion and the capacity to support each other, that would be unleashed through people not having to worry about their basic needs being met, is really the thing that I think has the potential to save the world.
Wow. That's one of the best answers ever. Love it. Love it. Beautifully, very eloquent, very well said.
Thanks.
Thank you. All right. Got an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into that dirt and start their own garden?
Again, a couple. Don't be afraid to kill things. Trust that plants really want to grow. And I think everyone should, I hope that in the future, as we proceed as a global community, that more and more people will be able to use food as a measure of the richness of your life. And have everybody examine their relationship with food, and it become a measure of how rich and wealthy we really are.
Oh, that's beautiful too. All right. Do you want to tell listeners how to find your website or how to connect with you if they had any questions or anything?
Sure. Into your search engine, put www.purplefroggardens.com.
Nice. Did you get a new website too? Did I notice?
No, we just updated it for the year.
Oh, okay. Looking good. Well, thank you so much. That was just amazing. I knew you were going to be an amazing guest, and thank you for taking time out of your busy day to share with us today.
Yes, and thanks for your patience over the summer.
Oh, no. I totally understand.
Yeah, it was fun. I when it seemed like the times that you contacted me were the times when I was the closest to the edge. So I was like, oh, that's not going to happen. So thanks for your patience and understanding.
No, absolutely. Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to check out our website, organicgardenerpodcast.com. That's just organicgardenerpodcast.com. And you'll see the links to everything that we've talked about today in the show notes page and all the other episodes there. You can easily search for people by name. You can download our ebook on organic gardening basics and subscribe to our newsletter for updates and just different things that are going on. Thanks for listening, and remember to